This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The front yard of a house in Normal doesn't have your standard lawn. It has corn, a lot of corn that started out as a kid project.
And then it just kind of evolved into, well, if we're going to plant some corn, let's plant a bunch of different kinds of corn. If we're going to plant a bunch of different kinds of corn, let's plant them in the order in which humanity developed them.
Passersby are getting quite a view. Plus, McLean County Sheriff John Sandage wants 1 or 2 months advance notice of protests and demonstrations on county property. Illinois State University football coach Brock Spack talks about a former player who debuts in the NFL this weekend. And Heritage Healthcare in Bloomington Normal is part of a new clinical trial of a drug to prevent COVID-19. That and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. The Bloomington City Council will talk about plans for the city's first cannabis dispensary Monday. The company that owns the cannabis shop in Normal says it wants to add a new Beyond Hello location at the former Slim Chickens restaurant site. Nathan Wang manages new markets for Jushi.
We were, incredibly excited to have the opportunity to bring the second location in the same community in a little bit of a more central location to hopefully give some better access to all of the new customers that we're now having and growing.
The company has asked the city for a special use permit. The city council in December allowed cannabis dispensaries to operate in the city, but under strict zoning requirements. McLean County stays on the state's COVID warning list for a second straight week. The county's positivity rate and rate of new cases remain too high. County Health Department Administrator Jessica McKnight says she hopes the warning gets people's attention.
When we entered that warning level last week, even prior to that, when we saw it approaching the city of Bloomington, the town of Normal, the county, and even the university have all stepped up.
The county announced 105 new cases today. A vast majority are college-age students. 9 patients are in the hospital, up 2 from yesterday. Illinois State University has clarified the way it counts positive COVID-19 cases. The university posts daily updates of positive virus test results. Some of those include students who test multiple times after their first positive test. The university's total of unique coronavirus cases is now nearly 1,300. There have been nearly 80 other positive tests that are second and third time tests of the same people. ISU plans to start posting daily numbers of unique cases on its online dashboard by late next week. Illinois' governor says the state's child welfare agency is improving. J.B. Pritzker says DCFS has required all employees to be retrained, among other changes, after 2 former workers were arrested involving a case where a boy was killed in McHenry County.
If there is anything that I think we can take from this case, it is that it has sparked a real effort inside the agency by the new leadership to make sure that this never happens again.
A grand jury said the 2 workers committed failures to fully investigate abuse, and that was a proximate cause of 5-year-old A.J. Friend's death. His mother pleaded guilty. His father awaits trial. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. McLean County Sheriff John Sandage says he's frustrated an ordinance to regulate public protests and demonstrations on county property has stalled in a county committee. A recent email to some McLean County board members shows that feeling. Sandage tells Eric Stock the plan has been in the works for about 6 months, but recent protests further demonstrated the need. Sandage says the measure should not limit free speech. He says county officials and law enforcement need to know who to talk to if issues happen.
A little more than a month ago, there was a rally and a protest out front of the Law and Justice Center, and a lot of chalk was written all over the sidewalks and stuff. And certainly that doesn't cause permanent damage, but it does cause overtime as far as having maintenance staff having to come in and wash that off. And also, it was some of the chalk was very disrespectful and done on a actually done on a memorial out front of the Lawn Justice Center to victims of drug overdose.
The ordinance, if we can go into a couple of the points in the ordinance where it suggests that the old courthouse grounds, the McLean County Museum of History, should be the primary place unless they can demonstrate that they simply can't hold it there because of sheer size. Is that an attempt to remove those protests that may take place or end up outside the jail?
No, I mean, that it has been that way for a long time, even though we had no procedure in place. In the past several years, all type of rallies, protests, anything, were urged to the old county courthouse, and that is so they don't interfere with courthouse business or with the jail.
Another one of the points in the ordinance where it references you need 30 to 60 days to have advance notice to get something put on the calendar for a demonstration to be approved. Some of the board members had seemed to indicate they felt that was an excessive amount of time that would prevent the kind of demonstrations that tend to happen in response to current events, you know, like the George Floyd protests or something along those lines. Would an ordinance still be workable if it did not require such a great length of time and still meet the kind of considerations that you're looking for your staff to prepare?
Yeah, and I've spoke to some county board members and said, you know what, the time frame doesn't, that's not a big deal to me. I mean, if it was 2 weeks, it would be fine with me.
It also asks for fines of up to $500 for organizers and up to $100 for participants who may be participating in this protest that would not be legally permitted. Where do you stand on that?
And again, I'm it's not up to me to pick the fine amount. I do think there needs to be some type of penalty if they don't comply.
So this proposal initially came up in what's called a stand-up committee, as you know. It's typically reserved for more procedural matters. Several county board members said that this is maybe too big of an issue to be done in this manner. It went to full county board. It got postponed again. Property committee, which typically handles this matter, they also had tabled this matter. So it seems to be in the state of flux. Why do you think it's not only not being acted upon, it's not even really being discussed yet?
I don't know. It's kind of disappointing to me. I mean, it's what's really disappointing is there's some members of the property committee who haven't even reached out to me and ask what my feelings are on it, or asked, hey, how can we better protect the Law and Justice Center and the jail? So that's kind of disappointing.
When we first started looking into this, we were more or less told that this was a matter that administration was taking care of. So perhaps they've not reached out because they don't see that it's something that is directly impacting the sheriff's office or something that you are actively behind. Is that possible?
Well, I've had several talks with administration that they've been very receptive, and as far as my opinion on the issue, but it's county board members that haven't sought out my opinion on it, or you know, the struggles we face.
The ACLU had submitted a comment at the property committee last week indicating that this could be a real constitutional issue if demonstrations are curtailed in any way. Is there concern that does potentially cross a line, that this may be too restrictive for what people feel are First Amendment rights?
Well, I'm not sure about all that. But I know that ordinances, the two that were looked at, they were copied from other jurisdictions. So, and like I said, the one was less restrictive than the city of Bloomington's. So I don't know what is different about ours or that what they say is we could be sued for.
That is McLean County Sheriff John Sandage with Eric Stock. The city of Bloomington calls for 60 days notice of an event, 90 days in its downtown, but a spokesman says the city typically waives that for protests. Sandage says 7 correctional officers have been injured during protests. The jail goes on lockdown during protests, because Sandage says the inmates get agitated. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Up to now, healthcare professionals have been playing defense against the pandemic. They've only been able to offer palliative care and try to control the spread of the disease. Now, the corner is starting to turn, and it's starting to turn in Bloomington Normal with an effort to actually control the who gets sick from the disease. Ben Hart is the CEO of Heritage Healthcare, which is participating in a new clinical study of a COVID-19 prevention drug.
We were asked about 2 weeks ago, we were contacted by Eli Lilly, and they're a large pharmaceutical company out of Indianapolis, very well respected. They're in the final stages of trialing a COVID-19 medication, and they are looking for candidates in the long-term care space. That's one of the focuses of their trial. And so they had actually reached out to representatives from the Illinois Department of Public Health and were then referred to us as being a quality provider of health care for the elder population. And so that's kind of how that introduction happened.
Why is our long-term care settings good for this antibody drug?
Yeah, well, as you know, in the national news and just throughout the world, that the elder population has been disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 in a very negative way. COVID-19 is a very severe and very serious condition for our nation's elderly to face. And so one of the goals of Eli Lilly has been to seek effective treatments for the elder population. And I know one of the challenges for them was that, especially in skilled nursing facilities, it's very difficult right now for residents to go to Eli Lilly, to go to them, so to speak. And so what they've done in this trial is they've basically created 10 mobile research units, as they call them, and they're basically large RV vehicles that they've retrofitted for this purpose. And so once a positive index case happens at one of our buildings, they'll actually deploy from Indianapolis and arrive on-site at our facility and conduct the trial operations there. So it's a very unique approach.
So what will they do when they get there? You've got one case, say, let's hope it's just one. You sequester that person away from the other population. Eli Lilly sends its crew. They give people shots, or is it an oral drug?
It's actually an infusion. And so what they're looking for is that first index case, or the first positive case amongst either a staff member or a resident. And they deploy to the site, they set up an infusion clinic inside of our building, and they can do as many as 10 infusions at a time. And what I mean by an infusion is an IV administration of the trial medication. And participation is, you know, solely voluntary by our residents or staff. You know, they're not forced to do it by any means. It's simply a voluntary process. So Eli Lilly takes on the responsibility of enrolling people into the trial. It's a stage three trial. So what that means, it's a randomized, double-blinded, placebo-based trial. So neither the people administering the IV nor the recipients of the IV know whether they're receiving a placebo or the real experimental medication.
How do you test whether the medication is effective?
Well, that's the kind of what Eli Lilly is undertaking, is they're measuring the effectiveness of their medication in preventing the onset of COVID-19. So it's an antibody drug that they developed from one of the first COVID-19 patients in the United States. And what they're testing is whether or not their medication is effective in preventing the onset of COVID-19. And so they've got their study set up to measure that against a control group.
Obviously, it's not ethical or legal to then expose someone to COVID-19 deliberately, so they have to leave it to chance. So they have to be looking for big numbers here in the study to ensure that a statistically significant population happens to be exposed by accident.
Yeah, and they're just within the long-term care subgroup of the Stage 3 trial. They're looking to have a minimum of 2,500 test subjects or participants in that particular part of the trial. So we're one of other participating members of their trial. They've got this same process set up in other states, but as far as Central Illinois goes, we're the only participant, as we know, right now.
If it proves out, is this drug likely to be a vaccination or a mitigator?
Yeah, I think the way they're terming it is a prevention. What they're trying to do is study whether or not their medication is an effective prevention from the onset of COVID-19. So
what we traditionally know as a vaccine.
Well, you know, I've asked them that very question, and their answer is no, it's different. It's an antibody treatment, so different from a vaccine. And so, again, it's what they're looking for when they arrive at one of our facilities is they don't want to test subjects who have already tested known positive for COVID-19. They're looking for folks who are either presumed negative or asymptomatic, or their test status is unknown. And then they are offering enrollment in the trial and testing the theory of whether or not their medication is effective at preventing the onset of COVID-19. So it's really viewed by them as a prevention rather than, I guess you would say, a vaccine.
This is not going to be a quick thing to be proved out. Or how long do you think this will take for results to be known?
Well, I think it's still a bit unclear to even them. I think it's going to be several months. We're most likely looking into the earlier parts of 2021 until the results are known. But again, I don't want to speak for Eli Lilly in that regard because they're more in charge of that timeline than us, of course. We're simply trying to aid them in that effort.
A number of healthcare professionals and caregivers in the Bloomington-Normal area have over the years sought out and participated in studies for Alzheimer's, for cancer therapies, for hormone replacement regimes. Those are just a few of the ones that I recall. Has Heritage participated in studies before?
To my knowledge, this is the first large base study where we've been a participant or a partner in. So this is obviously a big deal, not only to Illinois, but I think to the nation, because scientists are racing to find effective treatments and preventions and vaccines against COVID-19. And so we were interested in trying to help Eli Lilly in that regard, because we know firsthand how devastating that disease can be for the elderly. And we're really wanting to try and help the healthcare system find effective treatments and prevention. So that was our motivation.
Ben Hart is the president and CEO of the Heritage Operations Group in Bloomington-Normal. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Charlie. Good to talk to you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Redbirds join the NFL. More on that in just a few minutes. Passersby are getting quite a view from a home on Vernon Avenue in Normal. Instead of flower beds chilling in the front yard, there are 15-foot-tall stalks of corn. WGLT student reporter Cameron Kelly speaks with a front yard farmer about her unusual crop.
Longtime gardener Erin Ripley Gutarig grew up out in the cornfields. This summer, for her family's home garden, they got their hands on some compost with a lot of nitrogen in it. Not every plant does well with that kind of soil. It can burn off the roots, but corn is the exception.
And then it just kind of evolved into, well, if we're going to plant some corn, let's plant a bunch of different kinds of corn. If we're going to plant a bunch of different kinds of corn, let's plant them in the order in which humanity developed them. And so then it became a timeline of corn.
That ended up being a lot of fun for the family to dig into.
Because we got varieties of corn from a bunch of friends and family. We ordered some internationally. To have to dig back through there and find out that most of these varieties date back to before written history, or and definitely before European written history. Like most of these are pre-colonial, pre-Columbians. One of them was actually labeled as pre-Incan.
Erin says planting corn became an academic tool for her children who are homeschooled. 15 varieties of corn were grown in their garden. Some were local, others were shipped to them internationally from Central America.
And I never expected to like save money or feed my family at all, because if I had, then I would have like, you know, treated the plants and cared about the Japanese beetles and, you know, done stuff like that. But like this, like we knew we weren't going anywhere for vacations, and this is our fifth year homeschooling too. So it was like, just consider that an educational expense. This is an educational project, not so much a dinner plate kind of project.
Her children learned about world history as well as a timeline of how Europeans versus the Western Hemisphere worked with corn.
And then the stuff that I ordered internationally came from like what you could tell was a street address in Mexico or Guatemala, and it had somebody's name on it as the return address. So it was from an individual, like especially the teosinte, the plant that's like the native ancestor of corn, like what they cultivated out to eventually become corn. Like that came in a tiny little Ziploc baggie about like 1 inch by 2 inch. And it just had like a homemade label on it.
Kernels were planted and the children took stats of the plants. They learned corn kernels can come in different colors. Japanese beetles were a common pest while growing corn, and they got to look at those too. They ended up with only 4 ears of edible corn, but Aaron's family put it to use. On a summer day, the family made a sweet corn and melon and shrimp salad. The biggest tip Erin has for people at home wanting to grow corn is a little bit counterintuitive. Plant it in your front yard.
And we're on Vernon, so it's a very busy street with a lot of foot traffic, too, so the squirrels aren't brave enough to go up in the front yard.
Next season, Erin's family will be planting a pollinator mix that brings butterfly traffic.
It's going to be very disappointing to everyone because I've had requests to do the same thing with beans. Please grow a timeline of rice. Please grow a timeline of wheat. But it is going to be flower bulbs.
So while Normal may have lost out on the sweet corn circus in Uptown Normal this year, Erin's family had a little corn festival of their own right on Vernon Avenue. I'm Cameron Kelly.
Erin Ripley Gutarig's front yard corn made quite a splash. She was featured in an Illinois Farm Bureau video over the summer. You can watch it at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The NFL season has returned, and on Sunday, a former Illinois State University player will take the pro field for the first time. Running back James Robinson of the Jacksonville Jaguars made the 53-man roster this week and will suit up for an NFL debut. That's a bonus for ISU football head coach Brock Spack, who talks with WGLT student reporter Darnisha Mitchell about the ISU presence in the NFL this year. Spack says Robinson has a lot of tools to help the Jaguars.
Strong and powerful, a good speed, and he gets there in a hurry. So he's very sudden and can accelerate. But what makes it a really kind of a difference maker for a running back in the NFL is, are you able to catch the ball out of the backfield? And he can do that. He's a very good pass receiver. He's got very good ball skills. So that also helps. Also, he's a very physical guy in that he can protect the passers, and he is tough. So smart kid too. You know, he's got good height. He's got a good IQ. You know, he's stout. He's, you know, 5'10", maybe, you know, 215, 220 pounds. So he's compact, very muffled up guy. And, so he makes him difficult to tackle. So, cause he is so strong. And he's a little bit low on the ground and has good leverage. So he's a very good, you know, back from that standpoint, particularly for the NFL.
character-wise, in the locker room, off the field, what do you see him bringing to the team to help them fire them up and help them win?
Yeah, he's a guy who, you know, he has very little issues with James. You don't have to deal with any drama. You know, he takes care of business. He's very mature. You know, he's very quiet. He's not he doesn't talk a whole lot, but he'll smile. The good thing is he's all business. He's not, he's very mature. So there's not a lot of drama.
That's ISU head football coach Brock Spack talking with WGLT student reporter Darnisha Mitchell. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.